Well, we're quite a theme today, it turns out, of delving beneath some of the great changes underway in our region and beyond. And if you want to seriously understand how China finds itself starting to dictate some key terms of international development, as we've just been hearing from Adrian Wooldridge, you really need to revisit the epic story of its late leader, not Mao, not Zhou Enlai, Deng Xiaoping. To know Deng, according to my guest now, is to know contemporary China, a primitive, in industrial terms, just 30 years ago, 80% of its people living outside cities, to now becoming a global power base. The veteran American historian of East Asia says that of all the world leaders of the 20th century, the one with the most influence on the 21st is Deng. Ezra Vogel is one of America's leading scholars of East Asia. His latest book, Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China, took over a decade to research, the product of a passionate conviction about seducing Americans into curiosity about China via telling this remarkable human drama. So a very warm welcome indeed to the program, Ezra Vogel.
Thank you very much.
I think you decided that the best way, or you were given advice, am I right, from a friend who said if you want to engage the average American in the story of China, the epic story of China, look at Deng Xiaoping. And that is what you've devoted yourself to.
For the last 10 years, I've devoted myself to figuring out every possible way I can to understand what made him tick and what made his approach work in China.
And do you think you understand this man now?
I feel I do have a very good sense of the person. And if you ask me how he feels about one thing or another, I think if I don't know, I can give a very good guess. I've talked to his family, the people who worked under him. I've read his record. I've traced him. I've gone to his village where he was born. I've visited the place where he fought in World War II, the place where he was sent in the countryside in the Cultural Revolution. I've visited the places where he worked. And I've met the foreigners who met him and talked to them. And so I feel as if I have a sense of the man.
I'm just, before we go into details, because it's a 70-year career, I mean, there is so much in it. I don't think I've ever actually done an interview, to be candid, where there were every decade of this man's life, remarkable, extraordinary paradigm shift things occur.
It is extraordinary.
So it is not easy to do an interview, but this is just a very interesting final paragraph in the press release that accompanied your book. Deng Xiaoping may not have ended authoritarianism in China, but he was willing to risk planting the seeds of its ultimate demise. This most determined and hardened of men, the steel factory, to those who both feared and respected him, was willing to roll the dice to realise China's ultimate dream, modernity. When did the tipping point for Deng Xiaoping come that modernity had to be risked?
In 1976, after Mao died, Deng was still out of office and he didn't return until August 1977. And at that point, he was put in charge of science, technology, and education, which he considered the basic underlying fact of modernizing. And in December 1978, he took over. And within 2 years after that, he had set up his team and was beginning the transformation of a country that, since the Opium War, had not been able to join the rest of the world in the Industrial Revolution. At the time he came to power, the average per capita income was less than $100. They were short of food. They didn't have enough grain to feed the people. 30 million or more had died in the Great Leap Forward, and he was able to turn it around.
And yet, I think for a lot of Australians who just follow it in brief, he might be remembered most for being the man who put down the students in Tiananmen Square in 1989, ordering the army to shoot unarmed protesters. Well, through Li Peng, who was the head at the time. And of course, that was a dreadful event that shocked everyone. How does that event reconcile with all of that bigger drama that you described, bringing masses out of sheer poverty?
Deng was responsible for putting down the demonstrations in June 1989, And he had begun to make great progress in all kinds of areas, but there was a lot of resistance, and there were a lot of people who wanted far more freedom than he felt he could tolerate. And there were a lot of people who were very upset that inflation had gotten out of hand and they worried about their future. And on May 20th, 1989, he sent in the militia, unarmed, and told them to restore order. They marched through the streets, but they were stopped by the demonstrators who punctured holes in their tires and put buses in the streets so they couldn't enter. And at the time, the Eastern European countries were falling apart. The Soviet Union, communism was falling apart in the Soviet Union. And not just Deng, but the other high leaders in the party really felt that they were in danger of losing control of the country, and that they had no choice but to tell the troops to march ahead and do what is ever necessary to keep order. They shot at first in the air, and when they told people on loudspeakers to clear the streets, some people who didn't clear the streets and stayed in their way, who didn't move after they fired the shots in the air and the pellets at people, began to fire real bullets. And the best estimates by a Canadian scholar who was there at the time and went around the hospitals was perhaps 700 or 800 people were killed as the police clamped down. Mm. If you compare that with 57,000 or whatever it is, Americans who were killed in Afghanistan, it's a tiny number. It's maybe 1 or 2% of that number. But it was on world television. It got extraordinary coverage. And to many people in the world, it was a sign there was something wrong in China.
Well, is there any indication from your research that he ever regretted those actions?
I don't think he ever regretted it. He felt that it was a tragic thing to have to do. But this is a guy who'd been in many battles. He was in a turning point battle in the Civil War in 1947, the Huaihai campaign. Over 1 million soldiers were in that battle, and tens of thousands were killed. And for a person who had been hardened as a soldier and been through the ups and downs of revolution, he did not regret what he did to keep order and making it possible for China to grow.
Of course, he experienced firsthand the yield when China does spin out of control in the Cultural Revolution. And, of course, he had himself, you remind us, earlier in the 1957 anti-rightist campaign with the purging of China's learned, that he was organising the purging and the criticising and the jailing.
He was Mao's right-hand man in all those.
And well, did he regret? That was 550,000 of China's brightest were basically got rid of. A tragedy. Did he ever regret that?
No, not most of them were rid of. They were sent down to the countryside,
right,
and forced to labor, and some did die. But most of them survived and later came back after he came back to power. I think he did regret that. And he felt at the time it was necessary to keep order and to move ahead with the rapid modernization. But by 1959, he was beginning to act as if he needed to find a different path to make China work, and that the path that Mao had chosen of continuing revolution was not really making the country move forward.
My guest on Saturday Extra, I'm delighted to say, is one of the great students of East Asia, Professor Ezra Vogel, one of America's leading scholars, the Henry the Ford Second Professor at Harvard of the Social Sciences Emeritus. And his book, Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China, is, I think, regarded as a major new development in our understanding of this country's change. So I think his experiences in France as a young man and in the Soviet Union during their times of change, you believe, played a crucial role in setting him on this path to experience modernity through the role of science in particular.
No question about it. He went to France in 1920 as a 16-year-old. At that time, they couldn't get scholarships to study in the United States or Australia or Canada or European countries. And so the best place that they felt the students, bright students, could go was to France. By comparison to today's numbers, who went abroad as a result of Deng's opening and encouragement and support, there were only a tiny number. There were only about 2,500 Chinese studying or who went to France to study after World War One. But they played a very critical role in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s in pushing China to modernization. They had much greater knowledge of what was going on around the world, and therefore played a key role in guiding the modernization.
Mm. He seems to be a great pragmatist. He's not a great abstract thinker, you say, not a great political theorist. There's this great Deng's formula success. Don't argue, try it. If it works, let it spread.
So, yes, that's quite right. But he also was a strategist, and he had a sense of where he wanted to go. He didn't believe that capitalism is practiced in the United States or other Western countries would work in China, but he did believe that China had a great deal to learn from all the Western countries, and he set out in 1978 to learn as many lessons as he could and to move toward an open country. And even though he was a pragmatist, he could think long terms. For example, in Hong Kong, he said that for 50 years they can keep the same system. They don't have to have socialist organization or Communist Party leadership. They can keep their own system as long as it's considered part of the Chinese sovereignty.
Questions about his relationship with Mao and Zhou Enlai. He was loyal to Mao even after Mao had died, but there he was unravelling some of his work. So I wonder, what would his verdict have been on Mao? Did he see all the catastrophes? And Zhou Enlai too. I'm intrigued about that.
Well, he said about Mao that 70% good and 30% bad, and that the mistakes were in Mao's later days, that he made extraordinary achievement in his earlier days, uniting the country and bringing peace to the country and winning the Civil War. But after that, in the leadership beginning in the mid-50s, he was a utopian who tried to push too far and too fast and to keep the revolution going, which damn near destroyed the country with 30 or 40 million deaths. But having been in Moscow in 1956, when Khrushchev denounced Stalin, he was convinced that an overall massive denunciation of Mao would lead people to doubt the authority of those who worked closely with Mao. And he was therefore very moderate and very cautious in going about the two-year-long evaluation of the party during Mao's leadership.
And Zhou Enlai, who I heard Henry Kissinger the other day say was one of the two most impressive men he'd ever met in his life.
Zhou Kissinger was very close to Zhou and liked him very much. Zhou Enlai was a brilliant man. He'd been prime minister and he'd been in charge of foreign policy. He was very knowledgeable. He got along with Kissinger extremely well. But he was not meant to be number one. He was not the strong leader who would take initiative himself. He worked as Mao's number two. And ever since the 1930s, when he was subject to some criticism in the party, he never tried to take the leadership. He always tried to follow Mao, even during the Cultural Revolution. Deng was much more of an independent, bold person. He had been a military commander for 12 years and was of a very different makeup than Zhou Enlai.
Look, how do the Chinese today view Deng Xiaoping, Ezra? How does it differ from, say, the way they view Mao?
Mao, they believe, almost ruined the country through the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward. But there is a kind of nostalgia for Mao that comes from the fact that there's so much corruption in the world and among Chinese leaders who are enriching themselves and behaving even worse than many politicians in some of the Western countries in terms of lining their pockets. But the ordinary person is not willing to go back to the days of Mao when they were starving and short of food. The ordinary person in China is enormously grateful to Deng for leading them toward the path of reform and opening, for valuing education, for sending people abroad, for opening the colleges and universities and using merit as the basis of entry into the universities instead of political correctness. They wish he had done more to provide control over corruption. Some of them, wish, the intellectuals particularly, wish he had done more to push the country toward democracy. They wish that some of the military particularly wish that he had been a little tougher on other countries and feel that now that China is stronger, they can be tougher. But still, the dominant evaluation is that he was a great leader in China. Nobody else has done as much as Deng to raise their standard of living and to make the country a place that they can be proud of.
Well, Ezra Vogel, this is a snapshot. I can honestly say that of this man's life.
Yes.
Thank you for devoting 10 years of yours to it, and I very much thank you for your time today on Saturday Extra.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Ezra Vogel, the eminent scholar of East Asia. He's been based at Harvard since the 1960s, and his book, it is a tome, is called Deng Xiaoping and the Transformation of China. It's published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press.